On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Oh, good grief, poor Charlie Brown. He's the saddest boy in town. There's no hope, there's no hope. He's a wishy-washy dope. That's the first song that Vince Guaraldi wrote, but we couldn't use the words because they felt they were too mean. So the melody lingers on, but not the words.
That's film producer Lee Mendelson, who produced the original Charlie Brown TV special 50 years ago. We'll speak with him later in the show. But first, President Obama has joined almost 150 world leaders in Paris today. 40,000 diplomats, experts, and advocates are descending on the city for a two-week climate change conference. Here's a bit of what the president had to say to the delegates today in Paris.
What should give us hope that this is a turning point? That this is the moment we finally determined we would save our planet, is the fact that our nations share a sense of urgency about this challenge and a growing realization that it is within our power to do something about it.
Also today, Bill Gates and the leaders of 20 countries, including the U.S., are announcing Mission Innovation. That's a program to increase funding for clean energy research and development. Well, joining me to talk about the Paris Climate Change Conference, day one, is Andrew Friedman, science editor at Mashable. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, we have had these big conferences on climate change before, you know, Rio, Kyoto, Copenhagen, and none has managed to establish a lasting agreement on reducing carbon emissions. So why should we hold out any hope that this time it'll be different?
Well, I think there's several reasons why this time may be different. One is I think leaders are feeling much more political pressure at home. There's more of a global social movement that's pushing them to take action. Extreme weather events and climate change links are becoming more established in the scientific community and hitting countries, particularly developing countries, especially hard. And we've seen, you know, some extraordinary movement in terms of 160 or so countries pledging various actions, ranging from what President Obama is doing, trying to do in the United States in terms of reducing emissions, as well as abroad, what other countries are doing.
And these are voluntary, right?
Well, the international architecture remains to be seen in terms of the legally binding nature of it. But what Obama is doing, you know, is going to be done through executive action in the United States if it survives court challenges.
Okay. And what is he proposing?
Well, President Obama, the program that I am referring to is just the EPA's Clean Power Plan, which is to reduce emissions from power plants. Basically, the U.S. commitment to Paris, which is what he referenced in his speech today, is a reduction of 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by a certain year. So, you know, it's the furthest that any U.S. president has ever gone. We have the most credibility that we've ever had in these talks, much more than we had back in Kyoto, much more than we had even when Obama entered the world stage on, you know, in the Copenhagen conference in 2009. You know, the stars seem to be aligning for something to be agreed upon. The big question that activists are asking, that developing countries are asking, and that reporters are asking, frankly, is whether or not what we agree to, what countries agree to, is going to be enough. Because it looks like the temperature target of 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, that's like the global warming target, basically, that countries agreed to limiting global warming to. It looks like, you know, it's going to be very hard to do that unless the level of ambition of countries goes up considerably, which is what low-lying Pacific Island states and other countries that are particularly vulnerable are arguing for, very passionately arguing for today.
So what will that look like then if we're not able to limit the increase to 2 degrees Celsius and it goes up a lot more, let's say 3 degrees or even more than that? What will that look like and practically in the world?
Well, we're already seeing impacts of climate change around the world. We're already seeing more extreme heat events and more severe extreme heat events. We're already seeing melting ice sheets and potentially long-term destabilization of parts of Antarctica and Greenland. So the more warming that we get, the more risk we run in terms of both these extreme events getting worse, in terms of various cascading complex interactions that could affect national security, as well as destabilizing ice sheets and flooding coastal cities to a much greater degree. Recent research has shown that the difference between 2 degrees C of warming and 4 degrees C of warming makes a huge difference for cities from Shanghai to New York City in terms of, you know, how much of the waterfront might be put in jeopardy. These are, we can't pinpoint exactly what the differences are, but we know in general terms that once you go past a certain point, there's a lot of tipping points that scientists are very nervous about triggering and not completely confident about exactly where they exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's bring in Bjorn Lomborg. He is director of the Copenhagen Consensus Center. Welcome to you.
Good to be here, Madeline.
Well, it's great to have you. And you're skeptical, I understand, that anything of importance can be accomplished at Paris over the next two weeks.
Well, I think it's important to get a sense of proportion. If you look at what the challenge is and what we're actually offering. So as Andrew was mentioning, a lot of nations, almost all nations, have actually promised some sort of action. If you add all of that up, and that's what the UNFCCC, the guys who are actually organizing the event here in Paris, they've tried to add all of this up. And if you assume that everybody is going to do everything they promised and to the maximal effect in 2030, we will, in total, from now till 2030, cut about 56 gigatons of CO2. Now, to most people, that doesn't really mean anything. But just to give a sense of, you know, Andrew also mentioned the 2-degree target, we probably need to cut about 6,000 gigatons over the century. So in some sense, you could say what Paris is going to achieve, if we're really successful, is a little bit less than 1% of the total challenge. And that's why I'm pointing out, look, we got to be realistic. Yes, this is a much more optimistic scenario than what we've seen in the last couple of meetings with world leaders, but it's still far, far away from what we need if we want to get to 2 degrees.
And so what is then a better way of going about this? There has to be some kind of agreement. This is obviously a worldwide problem. There has to be some mechanism to get everyone together and decide on at least doing something.
Well, I think the really encouraging thing that happened today was Bill Gates and the many nations that are going to basically double their investment in research into green energy. Because fundamentally the point, and this is also the point that Bill Gates has been doing for a long time, saying, you know, look, if green energy is more expensive, it's going to be hard to convince most people to switch. You can get rich people to switch a little because they want to feel good, but it's actually very, very hard to get, for instance, India that wants to get rich, to get them to switch to more expensive fuel sources. So unless we make green energy so cheap everybody wants it, it's going to be really hard to get people to switch.
Okay, can you just go back a little bit and describe exactly what Bill Gates is proposing with this mission innovation proposal?
So it's probably better to ask him, right? But my understanding of this is that he is basically going to make sure that both a number of billionaires and philanthropists and also get governments to actually increase their funding dramatically into a lot of different areas. So look, there's a lot of different ways that we can make this shape out. And I'm not sure I quite understand exactly how they're going to spend this money. But this could be better solar panels, better wind turbines. But it could also be better fourth generation nuclear power plants. It could be about making, you know, for instance, algae that we can, so essentially second order, second generation biofuels that we could essentially grow oil on the surface of the ocean, just simply soaking up the sunlight and grow oil. It could be all kinds of amazing things. You know, most of these are not going to come through, but that's fine because we really just need a few of these technological breakthroughs to come through in order for them to power the rest of the 21st century.
All right, let's bring in Michael Levy now. He's Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
Well, what do you make of that? What do you think of this Mission Innovation Program as a possible solution to the world's climate ills?
I think it's a fantastic effort. They're talking about expanding the pipeline of new technologies coming out of government labs at the same time as they bring together people with a lot of money who are willing to be a bit patient and to be a bit public-minded to get those technologies up to scale and drive the cost down. But I don't think of it as a solution by itself. I think that searching for a silver bullet is typically a lost cause here. You have to be developing the next generation while you're transforming what we do today and while you're putting the infrastructure in place today that can accommodate that next generation of technology. So I don't think it's an either-or proposition. It's really one where we need to take action on multiple fronts.
All right. So action, speaking of the action that's happening on the Paris front this week and next, and President Obama wanting to reduce CO2 levels by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels, does he need to get the buy-in from the Senate to do that, the Republican-controlled Senate?
He doesn't need to get their buy-in. What he's doing is using existing laws in creative ways in order to drive lower emissions. But there are some complications that might come down the road. If he upset enough members of the Senate and enough members of the House, they could try and take away the authority he has to regulate these pollutants or the authority that a future president has. And that's something that where they haven't been able to muster the votes yet. So he seems to be in pretty good stead. And then the next question becomes, what does the next president of the United States do? Some of the initiatives that the president has put out there are going to move forward regardless because they're already being adopted into industry plans. Others, you might see a future president with a different view on climate change stall. And then we don't have all the policies in place that we would need to meet the goals for 2025 the president's laid out, and a different president might not pursue the full suite of policies that are needed to reach those goals.
Well, one of those policies is for rich nations to contribute to a $100 billion fund to help out poor nations who are disproportionately affected by climate change and can't afford to survive it. But very little of that money has been pledged. So what obstacles are there for the United States and for President Obama in coming through with, the U.S.'s part, which is, I think, about $3 billion or so?
So it's actually even more daunting than what you lay out. The promise was to try and raise $100 billion a year by 2020 to help poorer countries. So the U.S. portion would be $30 billion each year. Mm-hmm. And you can contort your accounting systems if you want and say we're on our way there. But the reality is that no rich country is close to what the poorer countries thought they were signing up for in 2009. Now, that's a political issue. That's something they'll fight about, and I suspect we'll find a way to compromise over. What we really need is to make sure that we have sufficient funds targeted in the right way so that they draw in private capital. We need to use the public money to help remove the biggest risks out there so that private money can then flow in and multiply the impact. So in India, for example, lots of people want to invest in solar power, but they're afraid that the currency exchange rate will swing wildly and destroy the value of their investment. If you can get a little public money out there and provide them insurance against that one risk, then you might see a huge inflow of private dollars into building up renewable energy in India. So it's creative things like that rather than just trying to rack up the highest total number of dollars you can that really matter to transforming an enormous system.
And is that what this Mission Innovation would do, is leverage public dollars to finance these private sector initiatives?
I think in a different way it would. The mission innovation would develop a host of earlier stage technologies that no one in the private sector will develop because they can't patent them. Once they've invented them, anyone can use them. And then try to feed them into a effort to commercialize those technologies. To be clear, the Gates Initiative has put up a lot of money in principle and a lot of government commitments in principle, but we don't have the details of it yet, so we can't say exactly how it will work. But what's exciting about it, to be frank, is that it collects investors who say, we're going to be patient. We had a gold rush in the clean energy investment space in the late 2000s. Everyone wanted to get in, make their money, and get out in 3 to 5 years. And that wasn't long enough. And you had a lot of potentially promising technologies wither on the vine. Here we've got people with a lot of money saying, we get it. We're not going to get a return on investment that quickly. That's fine. We've got plenty of money right now. We're looking at this for the long haul. That's what's pretty exciting there, that we could see a new model for investment in this area, for private investment coupled with public investment, that really opens new horizons technologically.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure, too.
That's Michael Levy. He is Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. We also heard from Bjorn Lomborg, Director of the Copenhagen Consensus Center, and Andrew Friedman, Science Editor at Mashable. All right. We would love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the Paris conference, about climate change? We'd like to know if you have made any changes in your personal life because of it and what you think of it politically. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, what is the link between climate change and terrorism? That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. At the Paris climate talks today, French President François Hollande said that global warming is a security threat on par with terrorism. Others have made more direct links. Earlier this year, the National Academy of Sciences published a study saying that Syria's long drought added to instability there, contributing to the civil war and the rise of ISIS. Elizabeth Colbert is a New Yorker staff writer covering environmentalism. She is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe and the Sixth Extinction, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. Well, I mentioned a scientific study that makes this direct link between the environment in Syria and the conflict there. What is the argument based on? What did that study say?
The study looks at rainfall. There's a pretty serious drought in Syria from the winter of 2006-7, I guess you'd say, to the winter of through the winter of 2009-10. And rainfall was very, very low. It was one of the worst droughts on record. And a lot of farmers failed. And as a result of that, and I should add also other factors, there are sort of, you know, there were subsidy factors involved, but at that time, a lot of farmers basically gave up and moved to cities that were already very crowded, and the authors of that paper argue that that was one of the precipitating factors in the Syrian civil war. And I think there's pretty compelling evidence that it was certainly part of the mix.
Right, right. But it's hard to pinpoint exactly a direct link, right, when you sort of make these arguments that weather, extreme weather, then is directly linked to global climate change, which is then, you know, a direct cause of terrorism.
I think that, you know, no one would say global climate change is, you know, what led to ISIS. I think they would say, there are people who would say, that you are destabilizing. Climate change is a destabilizing factor. It was one of several destabilizing factors in Syria in the lead up, in the years leading up to the civil war. The civil war has clearly very strongly contributed to the rise of ISIS. So there's a sort of multi-step process. Now, I think that the sort of important thing to keep in mind here, as we go into Paris, and John Kerry made a speech about climate change and national security a couple weeks ago, a very pointed speech, where he also drew this link. And over the years, there have been many reports, actually, from the U.S. military on climate change as a, destabilizing factor. We may never sort out any particular conflict. I mean, right now, we can't sort out, conflicts that are going on right now. We can't tell what exactly precipitated them. But if you think of climate change as destabilizing many parts of the world simultaneously, then it can be a pretty frightening picture.
Right. Even John Brennan of the CIA had said that recently. Extreme weather is exacerbating food and water shortages, which makes people more vulnerable to extremism. And yet this has become a partisan issue. Are you surprised by that?
Well, I think that's one of those, interesting sort of quirks of history, too, as you could argue. We will, historians will look back at that weird way in which climate change became, in the U.S., not everywhere, but in the U.S., a very partisan issue, and they will, trace that to various, individuals, probably, and decisions made at various inflection points. It certainly shouldn't have been one. There's nothing partisan, and there's nothing about geophysics. Geophysics is just geophysics. It doesn't really, it doesn't care what party you're in. And I think it could have gone very differently. And interestingly enough, many of the leading, voices, I suppose, in the Republican Party, to the extent that they exist, are very, keenly aware of and speak on this issue of the link between national security and climate change.
That they don't want to make the link?
No, they do make the link. In other words, it is a national security issue. We're not, if you're sort of saying, well, this is not just a, this is not, as it were, a classic leftist issue. This is an issue that involves national security.
And yet when Bernie Sanders made that link at the last Democratic debate, he was roundly mocked.
Yes, and I think that is very unfortunate. I think that he made a perfectly reasonable point.
Right. Well, I guess he and others are, and something I indicated earlier, I guess were criticized for making such a direct link. I'm saying this was exactly the link between the two.
Yes, but I mean, when we speak in political shorthands, let's mm-hmm. just say a lot of things have been said in this campaign that had less truth to them than that. Let's put it that way.
Right, absolutely. Well, can you look at other parts of the world, not just Syria, where this is affecting political stability, where it's causing more instability and more vulnerability to political extremism?
Well, I am not by any stretch in sort of global, either global, conflict expert or global, meteorological expert. But certainly, going back to the conflict in the Sudan, that was also preceded by rain, changes in the rains that some people argued, once again, I think I can't tell you if it's true or not, but it certainly seemed like a credible argument that forced people who were traditionally migratory herdsmen into conflict with farmers who were more sedentary. We are seeing now, across many actually parts of the world, severe weather patterns that disrupt food supplies. There was just actually a report came out from the Chinese government talking about worries that the Chinese have within their own borders, internally, about people being displaced by climate change and desertification, which is sort of an offshoot, I guess, of climate change.
Mm-hmm. And so in other countries, is it as controversial, or are people making the links more directly?
Well, I think that you can, if you consider this, I'd have to count the steps, but one step is between climate change and displacement. I don't really think anyone can argue with that. You can say, was this individual, you know, really displaced by climate change? But in a broad sense, climate change obviously is going to displace people. Certain people's homes are going to be underwater. I mean, we see that, for example, in a place like Bangladesh, people there. I just read an article about that, people being, you know, sort of internally displaced in Bangladesh as sea levels rise. So that, I think, you know, is a pretty clear, there's going to be a pretty clear connection there, in some cases clearer than others, obviously. And then you get to, you know, the link between any given, you know, displacement and conflict. And then that's going to be maybe a tougher link to draw, but maybe in some cases it will be very apparent too. I don't know yet. And then obviously, you know, conflict to terrorism. So there's all sorts of links there, but I think the point that John Kerry made, which is also seems a pretty valid one and a very difficult one to dispute, that in a world, a globalized world, a world of very where we're all connected in pretty obvious ways, you know, you can't wall off these effects. They're going to ripple out.
Elizabeth Colbert is a New Yorker staff writer. Her latest book is The Sixth Extinction. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in the program, we've been talking about worldwide catastrophe. Now, a personal catastrophe. Writer Dan Marshall's dad was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. His mom's cancer flared up again. In his early 20s, he had to drop everything to take care of his family. The result is a darkly comic memoir.
You know, ultimately, I think the whole thing made me sort of realize that you don't necessarily get to choose when you're going to grow up.
Home is burning after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 10 years ago, Dan Marshall lived a pretty carefree existence. He was in his mid-20s in Los Angeles. He had a fancy corporate job. He was in love. He partied and had a lot of fun. And then everything changed with a 1-2 punch of bad news. First, Dan's father was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Then his mother's cancer, which had been in remission, returned. So Dan put everything on hold and returned to his childhood home in Salt Lake City, Utah. His new memoir, Home is Burning, chronicles that experience. When we spoke with Dan Marshall earlier, we started by asking about how unsentimental the memoir is. And just a quick heads up, this interview contains a few jokes that use some sexually suggestive language.
There's meant to be sentimental moments, but it's overall trying to show kind of how sloppily a family handles these sort of tragic situations. You know, it's ultimately supposed to be a fun book showing how crazy a family can get.
Well, talk about your family, your crazy family. Go through the cast of characters.
Okay, there's my mom, who she's always sworn like a sailor. She swears a lot. It's hard for her to get through a sentence without swearing. I have my gay brother, who's a bit of an intellectual and can be pretty sassy. I had my older sister, Tiffany, who wasn't too happy about any of this. She was kind of trying to get on with her life. And then my little sister, Chelsea, she has Asperger's and is just probably the funniest and goofiest person I know. She loves fart jokes, for example. And then my sister, Jessica, she's adopted Native American. And during this time, she wasn't a very vocal person. So she was struggling a lot, but kind of had turned to drinking and flirting around with her lacrosse coach. And then my dad was kind of the center of all. And he was just a great guy. He was the rock of our family, the person that we looked to for help and support. And all of a sudden, he had Lou Gehrig's disease and was slowly made paralyzed by the disease.
So meanwhile, you were living this bro-y life here in LA. Right? I mean, it was the life.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was living that life that a lot of, you know, a very selfish life. I had a good job that I loved and a girlfriend that I loved and lived right off of Sunset Boulevard. So I felt like I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing at that age.
And your mom kept texting you and telling you to come back and take care of your dad. And you were like,
reluctant. Yeah. So she was, you know, so she had a relapse with cancer. And it was kind of at that point that she was like, okay, you need to stop jerking around in Los Angeles and actually come home and help.
Okay. And so then you come back and it's just everything's upside down.
Yeah. It was, you could see how much my dad did for our family based just on the destruction of the house. I mean, I remember pulling in to the driveway and I don't know, like Chelsea was a really bad driver and had backed up over our front fence. So the fence was down. There were bricks, like she had hit the side of our house too with the car. And so there, you know, just kind of bricks laying around, construction workers running in and out. The whole house, we had four cats who were engaged in a quite epic piss battle. So yeah, our whole house smelled like urine and had tarps all over it. And it was really crazy to see.
I want to get to one part in the book where you are trying out this new machine that your dad gets that will take the place of his voice because he has to get a tracheotomy. You have some fun with this, which I think really illustrates the tenor of your family and the kind of attitude that you have. And I was wondering if you could read that passage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we are at a facility at this point, and we have a communication device that we got my dad, sort of a Stephen Hawking sort of thing. So at this point, we're trying to decide what my dad's voice should be. So this machine was replacing our dad's voice, so we tried to find one that sounded sort of like his. But it was difficult. They were all very computery, a chorus of bad first dates, each with a name and gender. There was Will, who sounded like he had a bad cold. There was Rod, who was a little too chipper. We didn't want my dad to sound too excited about having ALS. There was Mika, who sounded like a tired donkey. There was Saul, who seemed to have been pulled out of a meth den. We finally settled on Mike, whose voice was a little softer. So I started programming. I need to go to the bathroom. I need a nap. Can you help me with that? I need to go to bed. At this point, I was bored out of my mind with this bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I started to ease into funnier, more risque quips. The dogs are barking. Can you get them to shut up? Please don't smoke around me. My lung capacity is at 18%, you inconsiderate. Wow, that was a great round of sex. Let me rest for 5 minutes and we'll go for round two. Boy, I could use a blowjob. I placed a picture of a limp penis as the icon for the blowjob button.
How did that go over?
I don't know. It was actually pretty entertaining. It was like anytime any friends would come over, it was kind of the first thing that we'd pull out just to show them all of these jokes that we had loaded into this machine.
Did your dad actually use that?
Well, he specifically didn't use that button. But the machine, it was, I don't know, it just, the technology wasn't quite there. So yeah, it turned into this weird joke machine that we'd use just to tell like blowjob goofs.
But also it illustrates kind of the humor, the gallows humor that you have in this book and that you had to employ throughout this period.
Yeah, I think it kind of embodies sort of my family's sense of humor. We always had a very crude, crass sense of humor. You know, we were one of the few non-Mormon families living in a very Mormon neighborhood. So our sense of humor was this sort of weird reaction to the goody two-shoes-ness of Mormonism. So yeah, it evolved into this really crass and crude thing.
And so would you just joke around with your dad about dying?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I remember like kind of, you know, towards the end of the situation, he elects to go off the respirator and he actually set the date for his death. And so it was a really weird thing. Usually people don't know when they're going to die. But I would come into the room every morning and be like, all right, like 32 more days left, Dad. And he'd kind of smile at me. So it was all really sad, but he understood that we needed to make some jokes or we were going to go insane because it was just so heavy and so sad to experience all of this. So.
Yeah. And how did your mom react to this?
Well, I mean, she was very up and down. So she was very, you know, when I got home, she was in the middle of chemo. So she was kind of out of it and sick. And, you know, we had to kind of take care of her. And then, you know, she started to get stronger and stronger, and her hair started coming back, and she was doing pretty well. But the moment my dad, we were all kind of gathered, announced to us that he had had enough, that he wanted to die. At that moment, my mom seemed to really flip a switch, and she just, like, you know, she started crying. She kind of went into panic mode, and she had been prescribed some pain medication for her cancer pain, some fentanyl patches, and so she started really using those probably more than she should have. And she tells me to this day that she doesn't really remember, like, the last couple of weeks, just because it was just such a blur to her, and she was just kind of so out of it. But she's still standing. She just celebrated her 60th birthday, and so it's kind of amazing. She's just like a real feisty fighter, and she just doesn't quit.
So what about you? You started this whole journey as a, you know, as you described, this rich jerk, and then you had to go through this whole thing where you had to put that aside, and you lost your girlfriend, you lost your job, you lost, you know, everything you were working for.
Yeah.
To take care of your dad. And how did that change you?
Well, I think I was completely, like, humbled by the situation, and I started to recognize that not everything in life is always good. Kind of after this all happened, I looked around and I was just like, wow, I have, like, kind of nothing now. Like, I've lost my girlfriend who I love, I lost my dad who I love, and I don't have a job. And so, I don't know, it was a really weird time. You know, I started drinking, like, way too much. But, you know, ultimately, I think the whole thing made me sort of realize that you don't necessarily get to choose when you're going to grow up.
And now there's going to be a movie made from your book?
Yeah, so the rights sold to New Line, and we have Miles Teller attached to play me, and Jonathan Levine is attached to direct. So yeah, really excited about that. I turned in the second draft of it last week. So.
Oh, you're writing the screenplay?
Yeah, so they trusted me to write the screenplay. I think they wanted the voice to be consistent from book to to movie and all that, so... So yeah, it should be really, really exciting. My mom, she'll text me who she wants to play her in the movie. You know, I'll get these texts like, how about Sandra Bullock? And I'm like, well, I think we're talking to Danny DeVito, actually. So yeah, it should be fun. It's going to be pretty surreal because, you know, it all started as a blog, and it's moved from, like, blog to book to screenplay to movie. And it's just like to see the story just kind of transfer onto all of these different mediums. It's pretty surreal, honestly. It's like really crazy that any of this happened or is happening.
So there are some crazy stuff happens in your family, and you write pretty candidly about them, warts and all.
Mm-hmm.
Were they upset at you at all for writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think they're ultimately really proud of me, and I think everyone's really happy that our dad's story is getting out there. And, you know, we lost our dad a lot sooner than we thought. So, you know, I mean, at least we kind of have this book, I guess, to sort of remember him by. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately they're proud. But, yeah, there are a few parts of the book that, you know, Chelsea made me take out a couple parts, and, you know, my sister Jessica wasn't super happy about a few of the parts. My brother Greg had to sign a consent form saying that he did indeed have pubic lice, and so he wasn't like super happy to sign that release form. But yeah, ultimately everyone's happy. My mom's reaction initially, she sent me a text message that just said, "F you, Danny, and f your book," and. And so, but she since has, like, really calmed down and is really, I think, proud of me. And I think there was a turning point. She, you know, it was like a BEA pick, the Book Expo of America. And my mom came to New York with me, and everyone just absolutely loved my mom, and probably more so than me. They were like, oh yeah, Dan, whatever. Like, your mom's kind of the star of the show. So I think once she realized that everyone wasn't laughing at her, that they were sort of laughing with her, and, you know, that, and she realized that I sort of wrote this book to sort of share her sense of humor mm-hmm. and not make fun of her. So I think once she realized that, she's just been, I mean, she's been great. She sends me, she'll see it in Barnes & Noble, and every time she sees it, the book out in the world, she'll take a photo of it and send it to me. It was right next to, there's some Bill Murray book out right now, and she was taking a photo of my book, and some kid, she was in some kid's way, and she's like, oh, sorry, like, I'm just taking a photo of my son's book, and the kid, like, looked at my mom and was just like, you're Bill Murray's mom? And she's like, no, I'm not a 98-year-old woman. So, yeah, she likes that it was written and that it's out there in the world. And so, but yeah, initially it was a little hard for her to digest.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you. This is great.
That's Dan Marshall. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Home is Burning. And Warren Alney is here now, fresh from his Thanksgiving break. Hello.
Oh, what a lovely break it was.
Yes, it was.
Yes. Did you have a good dinner?
I had a delicious dinner.
So did I.
And still have lots more.
That's good to hear. And that's the key about Thanksgiving is how long it lasts. We're going to be talking about the summit in Paris. Uh-huh. We will have a reporter who is on the scene for the Christian Science Monitor. We'll have Michael Mann of Penn State University, who's a real authority on global warming. We'll hear from the Maldives, islands in the Indian Ocean, which are already experiencing climate change almost to an existential degree, and who, of course, have a big stake in what happens there, and just get a sense of what's going, what the problems are, how much they've done in advance, and how much left there is to do.
Okay. Look forward to that at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much, Warren
Alney. Indeed.
To the point at 1 o'clock. And coming up on this program, believe it or not, it is the 50th anniversary of a Charlie Brown Christmas. So how did this odd, Derek, there it is. How did this odd, depressing story become a Christmas classic? We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. That music means Christmas is near. It's the theme from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which has aired on TV every year since 1965. This year is its 50th anniversary, and tonight on ABC, there will be a star-studded special to commemorate it. I spoke earlier with film and TV producer Lee Mendelson. He produced the Charlie Brown special, and he says it came to him in a roundabout way. Originally, Lee Mendelson wanted to make a documentary about Peanuts creator Charles Schulz, but no one was interested.
In typical Charlie Brown fashion, it never sold.
But 2 years later, the ad agency McCann Erickson called. They had seen the documentary and wondered if the same team could get together to do a Christmas special instead with Coca-Cola as the sponsor.
So I hung up, I called Charles Schulz, and I said, I think I may have just sold a Charlie Brown Christmas. And he said, no, what in the world is that? And I said, it's something you're going to write tomorrow. And there was another long pause. And he said, okay, we can do it. Come on up. And if Coca-Cola wants to do it, you know, let's do it. And so we got together the next day and literally in 2 hours put the outline together based on Schulz's annual strips about pressure on the kids in the Christmas plays. And we brought Vince Guaraldi back to do jazz and Beethoven and traditional music and hired kids to do the voices and not adult actors. At Red Hand's Christian Anderson's little fir tree. So I said, let's do something with a tree. And Mr. Schulz said, well, I want Linus to read from the Bible. And Bill looked at me and I looked at him and we said, uh-oh, this is kind of tricky, animating from the Bible. And we said that, and Mr. Schulz said, well, if they're going to do a Christmas show, we should do the true meaning of Christmas. If we don't, who will? And that settled that. So we sent by Western Union the outline. It took us about 2 hours, and they bought the show the next day and never came.
So Coca-Cola approached you, or the advertising agency that represented Coca-Cola approached you and said, Coca-Cola wants to sponsor Christmas special.
Yeah, have you guys been interested in doing one? I said, absolutely. Of course, I had no idea if we could do one or not. But that's how it all happened, yeah.
And because someone at the advertising agency had knew that you had done a documentary on Charles Schulz.
Yeah, they had seen it, and Coca-Cola had seen it, and they'd liked it, but they didn't buy it.
They didn't buy it. So is it kind of ironic that this is a special about or bemoaning the over-commercialization of Christmas, and yet it's sponsored by Coca-Cola?
Well, the whole thing is a paradox. Because it was about the over-commercialization, and of course there's nothing more commercial than Charlie Brown, obviously. But Mr. Schulz always said, you know, I just draw the comic strips. I don't deal with all these other products. If people want to buy them, fine. If they don't, fine. But I'm a cartoonist. I'm not a merchandiser. And although there is a paradox in the two, you know, both worlds exist. Those who amend it and those who enjoy it.
So what is the message of a Charlie Brown Christmas? What did you and Charles Schulz want to convey?
I always thought it was when Linus looks at the tree and puts a security bracket around it and says, all we need is a little love. I thought that was always the basis of Charlie Brown. And the message being, at Christmas time especially, you know, all we need is a little love. And it's usually with the whole family involved. Been 100 years of comic strips. Charlie Brown was the first one to deal with feelings, and certainly the Christmas show deals with feelings and comes out okay in the end. So I think that was the legacy of the show. Of course, we thought we had ruined Charlie Brown. Melendez and I thought it was too slow. Network thought it was too slow, but then half the country tuned in. There were only three networks back then. We got like a 45 share, and so now it's been on 50 years, and we thought it would only be on once.
Yeah, so did that surprise you? Because when you saw it together, you didn't think it was going to be successful.
No, we thought we'd ruined Charlie Brown. And when the animator stood up back and he said, you guys are nuts. This is going to run for 100 years. And, of course, we thought he was nuts. He's been half right so far.
So what did Coca-Cola think when they first saw it?
Well, the men, just like the network, the men weren't too enthusiastic about it. And I said, bring in your wives, your girlfriends, your daughters, your secretaries, and have them look at it, which they did. And then they called back and said, oh, you're right. Everybody went nuts over it. Because our main audience has always been the moms and the grandmothers and the kids who are more in touch with their feelings probably than we men are. And so even though all the men didn't like it, all the ladies and all the women and all the moms and all the kids like it, so we came out on top in that regard.
Yeah. Well, it's still kind of surprising that it's such a big hit because it is sad and depressed for most of it,
most of
the 30 minutes. And even the song is in a minor key.
The funny thing is, when it was over, a critic said, hey, Mendelssohn wrote the opening and closing song. And I called him up. I said, well, I know I wrote Christmas Time Is Here. I wrote the lyrics, but I certainly didn't write Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And he said, no, but Felix Mendelssohn did. And I always remembered that was very perceptive. I think the Schulz comic strip is bittersweet, and it has failure, and it has success, which is true. You know, in our everyday lives, we win a few, we lose a few. And like Charlie Brown, we keep coming back and trying each day. So there's a lot of sadness, a lot of failure, tons of unrequited love, but somehow everybody struggles through and to live another day.
So it has been on every year for the last 50 years. And do you watch it every year?
Oh, sure.
You do?
Get the whole family together. We have about 14 people in the family. We all sit down and watch it with the children and the grandkids. I enjoy it as much now as the first time we saw it. Although then I didn't enjoy it as much. I got to enjoy it better over the years.
And then it turned out that the critics loved it. The audience obviously loved it.
Right.
And now it's 50 years old. I can't believe it's 50 years old.
Yeah, and then we did 50 more shows after that. So yeah. all because of that. Well, you can't believe it. You imagine how I must feel.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Lee Mendelsohn is the Emmy Award-winning film and animation producer of A Charlie Brown Christmas. Julie Myers.
Hello. Happy Monday.
You too. Are you a fan of the Charlie Brown oeuvre?
I have a favorite character.
You do?
Pigpen.
Oh.
The one that walks around in the dirt cloud all the time.
Yeah, with the
Where
fries.
Where are his parents? Don't you
there
think
aren't any parents. That's the beauty
Is that
of this.
The point of the
no,
whole thing?
No, and then they have the teacher speaks with the sound of a trombone. Yeah.
I guess they probably don't have child services either then.
No.
Poor little Pigpen. Although that life looks like a good life.
I think he's happy.
How about you? Who's your favorite?
You know, I really like Marcy. So Marcy is Peppermint Patty's friend who calls her Sir all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And has a crush on Charlie Brown.
Is it because you want a Marcy? Am I your Marcy, sir?
Bingo.
Sometimes we learn a lot about ourselves.
On air.
On Press Play, sir. We had our listeners, of course, wanted to weigh in on their favorite holiday cartoons. We had a couple Grinch lovers, which I have to say that the Grinch has a special
like
place in my
too.
My tiny, coal-shaped mm-hmm. black heart. R.C. Langley says that for him, it's all about Charlie Brown Christmas. He loves the little tree. He loves the point of the story. It's his favorite thing about the season. Horacio Alex Olvera says, Charlie Brown Christmas, the best ever. 3 exclamation points,
wow.
He tweeted, which means he's triple hot on it. And we got a couple votes for the Abominable Snowman as well. Kicking it claymation, right?
Yeah, but super old and awkward claymation.
Like lurching claymation.
I
guess that works
charming.
For it, the Abominable Snowman, but with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, maybe not so much. So we also talked about climate change on the show today, and we asked our listeners if they had changed anything about their lives to make a nod at the fact that the globe is getting warmer. Michael called in, and he says that his wife and he both have electric cars. Mm-hmm. They stopped eating red meat and they decided not to have children, all in an effort to, reduce their carbon footprint. So they're going pretty hardcore on that.
Wow.
We'll keep recycling. So thank you, Michael.
All right. Yes, no humans. That would definitely solve the climate problem. Julie Myers, thank you very much. And let's stay tuned for another human on our air, Warren Olney, and To the Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.